Court will proceed to the fourth case, Bell versus Dupro. Mr. Olson.
May it please the court, I'm Jeff Olson. I'm a little worried that the court may be influenced by the fact that this case is about a luxury item, so I want to say one thing about that. Here is a luxury item, and most of us will get through life without one just fine, but when a man loves to sail and he loves his wife, a pier that lets her get on his boat in safety and comfort becomes a symbol. And when she's very ill, it becomes a very important symbol to him. The heart of this appeal is the principle that a party opposing summary judgment is entitled to the benefit of all reasonable inferences available from the evidence. To decide this case, the court must really only answer a few questions about whether certain inferences are available or not. The first one is, could a reasonable jury infer some antipathy toward Dr. Bell on Ms. Dupereau's part from the fact that she never told him the score? What I mean by that is,
I don't understand is why he didn't ask for a hearing.
He thought they were wired, Your Honor, and the court, I think.
Oh, wait a second. I mean, I can imagine. I mean, suppose a foreign person comes to the United States and asks for asylum. So the first official this person will encounter would be an asylum officer. So suppose the asylum officer recommends against asylum. And then, of course, you can ask for a hearing with an administrative law judge. Well, do you think the foreigner could short-circuit that process by saying, look, other asylum officers treat other asylum seekers better than this asylum officer, therefore, I'm going to bring an equal protection case. And forget about having to go through the proceeding before an immigration judge and the Bureau of Immigration Appeals.
He can't get asylum that way because he has to sue the defendant in an individual capacity and can't get injunctive
relief. Can he get damages that way?
I think so.
No, I don't think so. I mean, that would completely wreck the whole administrative process. If you can just promiscuously sue a first layer administrative officer on the basis that there isn't perfect uniformity in the treatment of applicants for benefits.
Not
never
perfect.
Is. You can't have uniformity. It's impossible.
I'm not contending that perfect uniformity is required, and you know, we concede in our brief that random variation is acceptable, random incompetence is acceptable, sometimes coin flipping is acceptable, but where there is this antipathy, a prohibited reason, we think that a class of one equal protection claim will lie.
Well, I think that's the animus situation, but the fact that she, you know, the fact that she kept them waiting while she's on the phone or that she puts her feet on the windowsill, that may indicate a lack of refinement or something like that. But how does that indicate personal antipathy?
Oh, the question simply is whether that would be an available inference to a reasonable jury.
How could a reasonable juror infer from someone putting her feet on a windowsill that she dislikes the applicant?
From the fact that she behaved in this fashion that most of us have been taught is rude and kept them waiting.
No, but a lot of government officials are rude. Even judges are rude, right? So we don't want to be sued by people who say we're rude.
There's
a difference between a market and a government, right?
These
people, Mr. Bell, he's not her customer, so she doesn't treat him with the same consideration that sellers treat their customers. But I don't see how that becomes a constitutional violation.
It doesn't in itself. It's just whether it's one fact that can go to an inference of antipathy along with the other facts.
What are the other facts?
The other facts are she didn't tell him the score. Namely, she made up her mind against him in February, but she sent him out on this wild goose chase to get engineering data without telling him that it was going to be useless to him unless he wanted to go to the effort and expense of a hearing. And she also said that when asked in her deposition, she couldn't think of any reason why she would have denied Dr. Bell if he would have designed in a flow-through, but she never told him that. And she said that she made a practice of telling people how they could fix their applications, but she never told Dr. Bell he could succeed by designing in a flow-through, so that provides an available inference of antipathy, I think. Moving to the issue of whether there are material differences between the Bell project and the comparator project that account for the Bell denial, I think the court should ask, could a reasonable jury have inferred from the fact that Ms. Duperreault never suggested that Bell consider designing in a larger flow-through, that the lack of a flow-through like the one Kane's project had was not one of her real reasons for rejecting the Bell application, that if it had been a real reason, she would have told him about it. And could a reasonable jury infer from the prompt and uncritical approval of the huge and destructive Halbrook and Pecherette project 2 years after the Bell denial that standards were not tightening across the board as Ms. Duperreault now contends they were?
So Halbrook and Pecherette, did the subsequent pier they built was the same size as Bell wanted?
Oh, much bigger. The Pecherette one involved blasting a deep harbor out of bedrock, and they were much bigger in terms of their dimensions.
And both of those used flow-through systems?
Not clear to me, because they weren't talking about flow-through so much by the year 2000. They used that more as a reason for the Kane grant in 1998.
What was this large project 2 years later?
Pecherette was an 80-foot breakwater in a 20.
Did she approve that or someone else?
She approved that. And Halbrook was 75 feet out and 50 feet across plus a boat ramp, and she approved that too. And
remind us of Bell's dimensions again, because you said these were bigger. I know it's covered in the brief, the dimensions of his pier.
Originally, his application was for a 60-foot extension onto his existing pier plus a 45-foot by 15-foot rubble mound, but by the time of the final denial, the rubble mound had been eliminated, and just an extension remained that was about the same size as the extension that had been approved the year before on the Hawkers Pier, 45-foot by 15-foot extension that was.
Well, you keep talking about Hawkers, Kuhn, and Halbrook, but I don't remember this Pecherette, or who is this person?
Pecherette. He's the last one in our list.
Discuss this in your brief?
Yeah, Pecherette is discussed in our brief. He's the last one in the list of comparators in the factual section of the brief. I've got my light on, so I think I'm going to ask if I can save the rest of my time.
You may, Mr. Olson.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Green.
Good morning, Your Honors. Let me clarify one thing right away, picking off on what Mr. Olson just said. The Halbrook and Pecherette project did come after Dr. Bell's application. However, both of those projects involved something totally different. The replacement, they already had existing old dilapidated structures, and it's undisputed in the record that DNR had a policy of granting greater lenience to riparians who were going to replace old dilapidated structures with new ones. So they got special dispensation not applicable to a project like Dr. Bell.
Size-wise, so how did those structures compare to the addition? I understand the distinction in terms of it was a tear-down and a total rebuild. You know, size-wise, how did that compare to what Bell proposed, his addition?
I believe, Your Honor, that they ended up sticking close to the original footprints of the existing project, and I believe, I'm not exactly sure how the square footage compared to Dr. Bell's application.
They're substantially longer, aren't they? They're 75 feet, as my notes indicate, and 80.
Right.
Versus the Bell amended is 50.
Right. These are substantial structures, and that is precisely the reason why the public criticized these projects, and Door County was flooded with these requests in the late 90s, and there was a lot of opposition. And in order to build a pier that's going to survive the action of Lake Michigan, it has to be quite a sizable, massive, solid structure. And that's the whole problem, is because they're built on public lake bed and the public water, and they impinge upon the public rights. Since 2000, there have been no permits granted in Door County. So what happened to Dr. Bell, essentially, was that he got caught in this transition where DNR, in response to the public criticism, essentially tightened the screws and decided it was not a good idea to allow these private individuals...
When you say no permits, you mean apart from replacement?
I'm not sure there are even any of those after these, after the Pescherette permit, Your Honor. There was an affidavit from Mr. Hanaway from the DNR that addresses that point. So there were some permits granted for municipal structures, but not for private structures. So what happened to Dr. Bell is, unfortunately for him, he came a little bit too late in the process. If his theory were correct, the government would be precluded, though, from changing its policies. And obviously, when the government changes its policy, someone is going to be the first to bear the brunt of the new policy. The Equal Protection Clause cannot be construed to freeze in time the particular policies of the government.
That's true, but he's also arguing on this sort of narrower theory of our Hilton case that there's enough evidence here that one could infer an irrational hostility on the part of Cupero to Bell. So
yes, and I think that
she didn't tell him that the engineering data that she was requesting, although as you point out, relevant would be relevant to a hearing. She didn't say it wouldn't make any difference in her recommendation.
Right. Although I think that Mr. Olson maybe overstated the case when he said she had a practice of telling applicants. I believe in her deposition she said that sometimes she did that, but it was not required and it was not a standard practice. There's nothing that compelled her to give a detailed feedback to the permit applicant.
Other than the defendant's testimony, what evidence is there of normal agency practices with respect to how this matter was handled or treated? In other words, is there some way we can know what normal agency practices were other than what she says they were, Duperreault, in terms of how he was treated?
Yes, well, we have the her field investigation report, which she completed and is in the record. I believe it's in our appendix. There's an affidavit from Mr. Fassbender, who was a longtime water regulation supervisor, who I believe stated that normal procedures were followed in this case.
What were those normal procedures?
That initially, upon receipt of the application, the water regulation specialist would go to the site and observe and fill out this questionnaire, which she did. Then she would send it to others in the department to review, and she did that. She sent it to the fisheries biologist and to the area warden for their review. Both of them, without consulting with her, returned the form saying they both opposed Dr. Bell's application. She then sent the file to the engineer in Madison for a review for structural integrity. That was part of the normal process. And then the engineer asked for additional information, and there was an exchange over the next year or so with that.
So his affidavit covers the steps she took were the normal steps in the process.
I believe there's a general statement that he reviewed the file and he thought that the normal steps were followed. There's one point I feel compelled to point out, and that is, I think, a serious error in the reply brief filed by Dr. Bell, and this goes to the causation ground. There are three grounds for granting summary judgment. The district court agreed with us on two of them, the lack of similarly situated comparators and the lack of animus. He did not agree with our causation argument, which essentially is that you cannot have a claim unless the alleged injury, here her opposition to the permit, caused the injury. The alleged conduct has to cause the injury. And as we point out in the brief, there's a Wisconsin statute that says very clearly that if a citizen files a substantive written objection, the case has to go to a hearing. We had objections in this case. The defense essentially is not that these objections are not substantive, but they assert that This is a policy that Ms. Duprow ignored regularly in other cases, and therefore he should have gotten the benefit of that ignoring the law, if you will. The problem is that the record does not support the allegation at all. He cites three of the other four comparator cases. The Pesharet case, there were no objections filed. But the other three, there were, to varying degrees. In the reply brief, at pages 4, 5, and then at 9, they say that all we had to do was put in an affidavit saying that those objections had been withdrawn. Their claim is the objections were never withdrawn, and therefore she granted the permit even though there were objections, and that violated the statute. That's simply not true. In fact, we did put in an affidavit, the supplemental affidavit of Ms. Duprow, which came in, I think it's docket number 45. It came in with our reply materials on summary judgment. And she specifically refutes the allegation that there were pending objections in those other three cases that were never withdrawn. In fact, Exhibit A of that affidavit is a copy of two written withdrawals of the objections in one case. Another case, there actually was no objection filed. In the third case, the objection only was to an expansion beyond the existing footprint of the structure, which didn't happen.
How is this? I've lost the thread. How is this related to the causation issue? I thought the causation issue was that because there were these objections from Pagel, there would have had to be a hearing anyway, even if she recommended.
And essentially, Ron, the way I read their defense is that that requirement is a sham because in practice she ignored the legal requirements. But there is no evidence that she ever ignored the legal requirements, and I think the court has to assume that the law would be complied with. And the statute is very clear that because of those pending objections, and Mr. Pagel said in an affidavit that no matter what DNR did, even if it withdrew its opposition, he would not, and he would insist on a hearing. So the bottom line is he would have to go to a hearing anyway, regardless of what Ms. Duperreault's position was. That, I think, totally undercuts his equal protection claim.
Has there been any defense of qualified immunity raised here?
No, Your Honor. On the issue of animus, I would like to address the point that Mr. Olson brought up in his brief, and that is the relationship between this court's precedent and the Supreme Court's decision in Olick. I believe there is a way to harmonize the cases, and this is what I would offer. There does seem to be a small subset of cases where the decision made by the government official is clear-cut. That is, in the cases cited by the Supreme Court, there were taxation cases where everyone gets 50% assessment, 50% of fair market value, except for you. Or in the Ola case itself, everybody gets a 15-foot easement to get connected to the water system, but you have to give a 33. When it's clear-cut like that, I think it's fair to infer that there's a disreputable reason for singling out that person, because there's no other apparent explanation. In a situation like this, where you have a government employee making a subjective determination, balancing different factors and exercising judgment and discretion, that analysis does not work. You can't infer from what appears to be inconsistent treatment that there was bad motive, and that's what Dr. Bell is trying to urge you to do. For all three grounds, I would urge you to affirm the decision below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Olson?
If standards really were tightening when it came to granting these peer permits, and if that was the reason Dr. Bell's application was denied, we lose. But if there's an inference available in the record that standards weren't really tightening, then we have a fighting chance, and we contend that there is from the following facts. The environmental assessment came out in 1998. That's the big item in terms of evidence of tightening standards that we have in the record, yet all of the comparator applicants were granted after April 1998. And in the year 2000, Halbrook and Pesharet's big destructive projects, bigger than the existing footprints of the items they were replacing, were granted without any negotiation at all to attempt to get them to go back to a less environmentally destructive scale.
But didn't they all contain that flow-through feature?
I think so.
So, I mean, that would be compatible with recognizing the change, wouldn't it, Mr. Olson?
The piers contained a flow-through feature, but the big break wall does not. For example, the Pescherette 80-foot break wall doesn't have a flow-through. That's justified strictly on the basis of replacing an existing structure, but that one and the Halbrook one are much bigger than any existing structure.
But you don't base your argument on the policy, a discriminatory policy of favoring those with the piers in place versus people who have not. You're not challenging that.
If that's what they're really doing, that's their true motive, that's legal, and we lose. But we're arguing that the jury could infer that that's not the true motive.
And what are you seeking by way of relief?
We're seeking damages for the loss of the use of the pier that Dr. Bell would have had over the time period had his pier been granted, and the expenses that he was required to incur in fighting his way through this process.
But shouldn't he have had to mitigate his damages by seeking a hearing?
Well, if the state had wanted to defend on the ground of mitigation, it would have been their burden to prove that he could have had a hearing and won it. And if they would have proven that, they'd prove their mitigation defense.
Couldn't he have requested a hearing?
He could have had a hearing. He just canceled his request very recently. But there's no, the mitigation is their burden, and
I just don't understand why you don't have to exhaust your administrative remedies. Why you come running into court when you could have had an administrative proceeding, gotten this thing resolved? And even if you lost at the hearing, it'd be more of a record, and we'd have a clearer idea of what's involved here.
We're not experts on
placement of piers in Lake Michigan. Presumably the hearing would be before some kind of administrative law judge who had some sort of experience in administering regulations of the Department of Natural Resources. Then we'd learn something about the situation where there was a real injustice here.
The court might have to go all the way back and deal with Passy versus Board of Regents that says you don't have to exhaust your administrative remedies if it wants to take that route. Certainly,
well, you don't have to exhaust your administrative remedies if you have a cause of action. But there are many cases, many of these constitutional tort cases, in which your cause of action depends on what happened to you in the course of seeking, relief from the state. The Parrott versus Taylor type of case, if you lose property, in a cell or something like that, you're a prisoner. If the state has some procedure for making a claim, you have to exhaust that. You can't just say you were denied due process.
That's right.
And that's due process. Maybe equal protection is different. It just seems to me that it would be much easier for us to deal with these cases if we could say to people, look, before you make a federal case out of this, see whether you can get what you're seeking from the administrative officials. Don't stop with the first line decision maker, accept that person's decision, and run into court to challenge it.
Before you do that, ask, what would have been the situation if Dr. Bell's wife had actually died of her cancer in the year 2000, and he loses all heart for this peer project and decides he doesn't want the peer, he doesn't want the hearing, he doesn't want the headaches? Would he still have a claim for the delay in getting the peer up to that point that he suffered and the inability to use it up to that point? I think Esmail versus McCrane says he would. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Wilson. Thank you, Mr. Green. Case is taken.